You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
City Limits. Brought to us by the People's Committee for Melbourne every Wednesday at 9am.
City Limits is Melbourne's only hour devoted to our urban environment.
To transport and planning and housing issues.
To privatisations and our utility services.
To building and or maintaining a sense of community. 855 on the AM band, if we can hear it through the noise and find it through the smog.
City Limits.
Here we are, and it's 3CR. It's 9 o'clock spot on today. And
we did well, didn't we?
And it's therefore Wednesday morning. It's also therefore City Limits time, and it's the fourth Wednesday of the month, I think. Today we're going to be talking to Helen Vandenberg, long-time community activist and campaigning these days, particularly around water issues. And we're going to talk about water issues, including the impact of these data centres on water. So we'll talk about that. I'm Kevin Healy. Anne Maxwell's over there. Anne, how are you?
Good morning, Kevin. I'm pretty good.
It's pretty
didn't
good.
Rain on me today, so I'm happy.
No, I tossed up whether to come on public transport, and I realised it wasn't going to rain, so I rode the bike.
You rode the bike. Yeah, yeah. You were in your high vis when you walked in.
I was, that's right. So there you are, proved it. And a cup of tea, by the way. I mean,
oh, yes.
In fact, you got the cups ready today. So
I did.
Have you got a choice of these two cups between which one you want?
You know my short-term memory? I can't even remember which ones I pulled out.
One is a 3CR cup.
Oh, yes.
And the other is a...
It's the Chinese, Repel the Invaders.
Chinese communist-looking cup.
Let's go communist today.
Okay, you go communist.
Cheers.
There we are. And we've got a green tea today.
Got a green tea, okay.
Yes. In the last few days, there's been a lot of discussion about the 50th anniversary of the dismissal and people remembering where they were if they were of an age to be around at the time anyway. And just for the record, I was in Perth when it happened. I was on holiday and my partner and I were on a bus, and I said to her, I think the radiator said the government's been sacked. And that's how I came aware of it. And I got a call that night to Dax back to Melbourne and start working on publicity for the campaign. And I said, look, I'm on holiday. I'll be back when I'm back. And that's that. So there you are. What I wanted to raise was all the possibilities that the people have been talking about and the ins and outs of what might have been if this had happened and that had happened, et cetera. One that's hardly had a mention, it's had a couple of small mentions, was the fact that the only reason that the Senate was able to block supply anyway was because the Queensland and New South Wales governments had broken the convention leading up to it. Because the Liberals, the opposition, wouldn't have had the numbers in the House. But the convention was that if a senator resigned or died, you replace them, the state government replaced them with someone from the same party.
Right.
Now, since this event, that's now been made law that they have to do it. Then it was but a convention.
Right.
And in the months leading up to what happened, in Queensland, a Senator Bert Milner died and Bjelke Petersen broke the convention and put in a Conservative. And in New South Wales, Lionel Murphy went from the Senate to the High Court bench and created a vacancy. And the then governor, the then premier, another Conservative called Tom Lewis, also broke the convention. They both put Conservatives in. Now, if that hadn't happened, the Liberals wouldn't have had the numbers.
And they wouldn't have been able
to block supply. That's right. So
they were playing dirty for quite some time leading up then.
Yes. So that's something that hasn't been mentioned a hell of a lot. But
no, let's remind people.
Yeah, I just thought it was worth mentioning.
That, yeah. They do play the long game, don't they?
Yeah.
And get their pieces all lined
so,
up.
So that was that. And just as a by the by on this, because you know, they're talking about all the problems of the government, but you know, they also did some quite wonderful things. We know free education. They brought in Medibank. In fact, they brought in. Mm. In fact, Albanese got that wrong because he talked about Whitlam bringing in Medicare, which he didn't. He brought in what was called Medibank. Same thing, really, but a different title.
Mm-hmm.
But then the Fraser government got rid of Medibank.
Mm.
We had a Medibank Action Coalition, in fact, running, and
we had a
march through the city where I was at the front of a coffin, and the bloke was about 2 foot taller than me on the other side, so it made it very difficult to march it along. But of course, what he did was privatise Medibank. So what is now the Medibank Private Insurance Company is what was the Federal Medibank.
Okay.
So he actually handed it over to the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
And it was later on that in the Hawke Keating government that Hayden, as the minister, brought in Medicare, which is the one we've now got, supposed to be free universal, but sadly, thanks to Howard playing around with it, it's no longer free. And you know, there's a lot of costs involved that shouldn't be there.
Mm.
It should be a free universal health system.
It should be. Yeah, the bulk billing sort of gradually disappeared, although I think they're trying to resurrect it.
Yeah, trying to resurrect it. But I'm fortunate that we still have a medical centre set up by Whitlam, in fact, that still has doctors and it's still free, or it's free to pensioners. They bulk bill pensioners anyway. So I think non-pensioners have to pay something there now to be treated, but yeah.
Right,
But the one I was going to raise, because in the first week when Lance Barnyard and Whitlam were the government, just the two of them,
they had a bit of fun, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. they talk about all the things they did, but one thing they did that hasn't had much mention, but I think was critically important at the period, was that they banned the landing rights of South African airlines.
Oh, okay.
Now, the previous government with Gorton, McMahon and co. before them had been massive supporters of apartheid in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they called the blacks terrorists. You know, the massive majority of Africans were terrorists,
yes.
apparently. And people of my age will recall that the head of the RSL, Rustam, I think his name was Rustam, whatever it was called, he actually called a Nobel Peace Prize winner in Archbishop Tutu a witch doctor. He called him a witch doctor. They reversed that, and then the government then took a strong stand against apartheid and against South Africa. But that didn't start until the first week of the Whitlam government, when the first thing they did was withdraw the right of South African Airlines to land in Australia.
Which how Labor has changed.
Yes, how much so, that's right.
Yeah.
So I just thought I'd raise that. Now, one of the great minds of this world, I've never actually seen these people on telly or whatever, I don't even know what they do, particularly other than they're obviously celebrities for being celebrities, these Kardashian people.
Oh, yes.
But I always think they must be great minds, although, of course, they've got enough mind to make fortunes by being whatever they are, doing whatever they don't do. But anyway, but this is interesting. Kim Kardashian in 2019 decided she was going to study law.
Mm.
Yeah, she announced it in an interview with Vogue magazine. Well, where else would you announce such things but in Vogue, of course, if you're a Kardashian. Now, this week she had another law exam, and damn it, she failed again. So, 2019 she started. Here we are in 2025, and she still can't pass the exam. But she's going to keep trying, she says.
Oh, good for her. Like, persistence will pay off, Kim. And a bit of study.
That's right, yeah. Well, study hasn't worked, obviously. Anyway, that's Kim. Just thought I'd mention that.
I wonder what kind of law she wants to go into.
Oh, it'd be interesting, wouldn't it? Who knows? I would say if I were
immigration rights, I think she wants.
Maybe, yeah, maybe. She could. That's right. Mm-hmm. Kardashian, yeah, she could. She could. In fact, she might be lucky. Trump might throw her out of the country with a name like that. Now, here's one that would almost conforms to the sort of economics you do on your program. Almost conforms.
Right.
The RBA, as we know, is actually in debt, the Reserve Bank. In fact, on the week that was, I called the Reserve Losses Bank because, you know, it's
deep in debt, but it went into debt during COVID when it took out government bonds and other things to bolster the economy. Mm-hmm. But as things collapsed and interest rates and everything happened, they ended up with massive debt that they're still in.
Mm.
But a couple of so-called renowned capitalist economists, Peter Downs and Warwick McKibben, they've argued that the government should get them out of the hole, get them back to equilibrium, and just add to government debt. And it says how it happened. They purchased these things, and the low-cost funding provided to banks during the crisis became a drag on earnings, etc. Mm. The combined result was a negative equity position, a battle wound that without recapitalisation, etc. In a narrow technical sense, a central... Now, this is the bit that you might find interesting.
Yes, I'm finding it all interesting, and I'm...
In a narrow technical sense, a central bank cannot go broke.
Right.
It can always draw down on its accounts further to meet obligations, but a lack of capital adequacy can undermine clarity, confidence and independence. Wait long enough and the floor is likely to be exposed, etc. Recapitalising the bank, like putting on a seatbelt, doesn't cost anything. The transaction is purely an accounting one, drawing the RBA's losses, an entity owned by the Commonwealth, onto the Commonwealth balance sheet. The transaction has only a one-off impact on the headline deficit, albeit a large one. A transfer of around $40 billion is required to restore the ABA buffers to roughly the level they have been since the 80s. Mm-hmm. After that, the budget returns to exactly where it would have been before. It has no effect on the taxpayer. There you are.
Yep. Pretty kind of, that's kind of right, you know, from my point of view.
Yeah, I know.
Except this idea that that it's not going to affect the budget, or that they can always find the money, like that's also applies to the debt. So the argument that we make is that the debt is not actually a debt, although they call it a debt.
Yeah.
So there's nothing to fix.
I did say almost your argument.
Almost.
Yes, yeah.
So it's like, yes, their solution I would agree with, but the problem is a mythical one. So there's no problem to fix.
No, that's right. Although working class families trying to pay their bills might think there is a problem with debt, of course, from their point of view.
Yeah, well, that's a different kind of
that's,
debt.
That's right.
Yep. So like they say, it's just an accounting operation. It's just moving numbers around in their spreadsheets.
Now, we also know that the previous governments had spent trillions and trillions on consultants and cut back on public servants to a great degree.
Mm-hmm.
And the new government that came in has in fact made some fairly serious attempts to employ more public servants and use less consultants. And, of course, we know recently Deloitte's, for instance, you know, were exposed, that one where they did it with AI and discovered they've now discovered that they thought there were 14. I think it's growing to massive numbers of
the
mistakes in the whole thing. That's
the
right.
Yeah,
people look at it and find there's just mistakes everywhere.
And that report, by the way, was to cover up the fact that mutual obligations is a complete abuse of power too.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. and anyway, the... Now the capitalists who of course include the consultants themselves, are complaining because the public sector wages bill has blown out.
Okay.
Blown out. It's jumped by 7.6%, would you believe? Yes. Oh, God. prompting economists to question whether Federal Labor's pivot away from employing consultants is working to save money or simply adding to deficits.
Oh, no.
No, yes, no. It's very sad, isn't it?
Get
back to the consultants, I say, and waste your money there.
This is why people need to understand what deficits are so they can't be used to frighten people away from sensible governing.
And, of course, they then quote, they claim him independent economist Chris Richardson. Well, he really annoys me. He's one of those ones that, you know him?
Who's he associated with?
I can't think which one, but he's always commenting, and he always sounds so reasonable from a
oh, they
economic,
give you all their jargon,
economic rationalist way.
Yes,
yeah.
That's right.
Said it made him sceptical of forecasts that suggested government wages costs would remain steady over the next 4 years. It would appear the wage pressure is beating the budget forecast, and that is always the likely outcome, he said. He said the 7.6% public sector wages bill growth compared to 5.4% in the rest of the economy. This is a swing toward the public sector. Part of that, of course, is by design. It's the swing away from consultants. We knew that, at least. It was entirely reasonable for the government aim to spend less on consultants, but at this point, the jury is still out. Success is yet to be demonstrated, he said.
Oh, Lordy.
What's success mean in this case, by the way?
I wonder what their total spending on consultants was.
Well, they still spend a fair bit, by the way, on consultants anyway, but they are trying to wean themselves off.
It's going to take a while to regain all those skills and to re-skill up the public service,
And the state government, in one of the better economic performances also, has set up an inquiry to look at cutting back on costs, which includes mainly slashing the public sector, unfortunately. and it's interesting that it's happening just as the new broom has swept into the public sector union, by the way, which is much more radical union. And what they can do, who knows?
Right.
Giselle Hannah, of course, who's a regular on this station for many, many years, is now the secretary of that union.
Oh, okay.
And she's still doing programs on 3CR.
So you can weaponise the budget, of course, always.
Yeah, but the thing is, the people running the inquiry for them in the department, Premier and Cabinet Secretary, they gave contracts to Gilbert and Tobin, a couple to Ernst & Young and the Nous Group. So they've spent $2 million on consultants to work out how to stop spending money.
If digging isn't working, just keep digging deeper.
Yeah, so I found that rather interesting.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's good for good for the economy to get rid of public servants. So they're doing the reverse of the federal lot, obviously. So Chris Richardson might be pleased with them, of course.
I wonder if he's been having a word in their ear.
Yeah. Now, on a quite serious note, we might even make fun of this one. Almost half of the city of Melbourne, this is an incredible figure, almost half the city of Melbourne's residents experienced food insecurity this year, according to a council survey, a dramatic rise from one-third reported 2021, which probably was the last report. The 25 data shows 47% of residents reported food insecurity, 32% worried they would run out of food, 28% skipped meals, 20% ran out of food, and 19% accessed food relief organisations. While food insecurity is not new, the pandemic, growing financial hardship and cost of living pressures have exacerbated the issue, the council said. The annual social indicators survey gathers data from residents and tells how it does it. And it's jumped from a 2018 pre-COVID level of 26.2% to 47%. At the milder end of the food insecurity spectrum, 27.3% of adult residents worried about food running out before they had money to buy more, and 21.6% reported they had used coping strategies to manage not having enough food. At the more severe end, 19.3% reported that there were times in the past 12 months when they actually ran out of food and could not afford to buy more.
One in five people in Melbourne are running out of food.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
Altogether.
Yeah. You know, and you would think who would get behind this would be your grocery store lobby, because they must be, not having as much income because people can't afford to buy food.
No. Yeah.
So, yeah. And so where's all the money going?
Higher wages. That's what you need. And then with great perspicacity, the Victorian Council of Social Services has fingered the problem. Guess what it is?
Oh, tell me.
Poverty.
Who would have thought?
Poverty is the obvious underlying factor.
Yes. Yes.
And an ongoing survey and et cetera, and named the council. The city of Casey ranks highest with 56,548 people living in poverty, followed by Hume, and they give the figures. Hume, Wyndham, Whittlesea, Brimbank, Greater Geelong, Melbourne ranks sixth. So, you know, they're all pretty much working class areas, as you can tell. Yeah. And the government has responded with additional investments of millions and all that stuff, but nonetheless it's still happening. But it's a pretty serious problem, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the the cost of living. So a lot of the, you know, a lot of people's incomes are going into just trying to house themselves, and then they end up not spending on food. And where does the money go when they're spending on housing yourself? In the end, it goes through to the landlords, which goes through to the banks. And the banks, are they making a bit of profit at the moment?
They loan it back to the people trying to buy a house. And in fact, there was a report on the news last night, which we've known for a long time as well, that that increasing numbers of people are requiring two jobs just to survive, which means, of course, your whole life cycle and lifestyle is thrown into a skew.
Yes, exactly, exactly. You lose your time then. So, yep, if we had a job guarantee, that would put a minimum wages and conditions floor under all jobs.
Yep.
So then nobody could be underpaying you or doing wage theft or anything like that.
Well, in fact, there's been a move to the union is seeking... it's in South Australia, but they think it will spread if it gets successful there. Union is fighting for apprentices to get livable wages because they say, well, for the term of your apprenticeship, virtually you've either got to live at home or you can't survive on the wages. But the bosses are screaming and yelling, saying this will add costs and it's a terrible thing and they'll employ less apprentices and it's the usual, the usual end of the world if it happens.
That's right, that's right.
They may as well let them starve for 4 years and then they can go out and make lots of money.
decent Austudy, decent wages for apprentices, double the unemployment rate and have a job guarantee. Problem solved.
Now, we're going to talk to Helen about water and it's not unrelated to this. But planetary heating is accelerating because of dangerous feedback loops which are already contributing to global instability. Top climate scientists write in the 7th Annual State of the Climate Report, while the most effective levers to avert catastrophe include deploying renewable energy, protecting forests and improving farming practices. A collaboration by climate scientists from North America, South America, Europe, Asia and Australia, the paper notes 2024 set a new average global surface temperature record and was probably the hottest in 125,000 years based on the glacial record. And it goes on, and it's it goes on with pretty miserable stuff. Combined solar and wind consumption also set a record, but was 31 times lower than fossil fuel energy consumption. Coal, oil, and gas were all at peak levels last year, and it goes on and on. I raise that because it's important to raise it, but more importantly. We are a great fan of Meg O'Neill of Woodside. Meg O'Neill before Profits of Woodside with Profits. Meg is a great believer in the transition from gas to gas. so much so that she's got that 40-year now contract to run to destroy a rock art and... the transition obviously is a very slow process. But this is wonderful news. Prepare yourself to which I'm going to in fact pour a bit more tea. Do you want a bit more tea right there? Or?
No, I'm holding on to my cup here. Kevin.
Right. Well, hang on. I'll have a sip because this is. Hang on, listen. This is great news. This is whooping news. Woodside Energy Chief Executive Meg O'Neill says the world has changed. It certainly is thanks to her. It's
changing.
Yes,
rapidly.
Changing. And investors recognise that demand from data centres and artificial intelligence means, and this is the great bit, there is plenty of money to be made from fossil fuels for years.
I just bit my cup.
Isn't that wonderful news?
Oh, no.
Yes, wonderful. Plenty of money to be made for years and years. And in fact, the story goes on about how they're investing all over the world in oil and gas. And so she's really throwing herself into the transition, the old Meg, isn't she?
She is. We're all going to be, these artificial intelligences in our little heat-proof suits.
Yes, no.
On a desert planet.
Bloody wonderful. It's great. Now, we also know that with Murray Watt's new environment law... he's bringing in, Well, the history, as we know, is that that his predecessor attempted to, that was Plibersek.
Plibersacked
by Albanese. she made an attempt at least to do something about saving the environment, you know, at least. And, of course, the Western Australian Premier Cook.
She took her job seriously.
Yeah, Premier Cook and the fossil industry like Meg and the others over there, Santos, etc., they all kicked up such a fuss that Albanese buckled at the knees as usual, threw out her legislation and put Murray Watt in the position after the last election to do the job. And Murray has consulted extensively with all the parties, the fossils, and Roger. That's right. he's come up with a law. It seems strange that in environment law, there's all sorts of industry policy about speeding up processes to approve all these pollution
Well, the faster
fossils.
You go, the better environmental decision you will make.
And in fact, it's the environment part of it is quite contentious, obviously, because Susan Lee says, she says that they should break it in half, immediately pass the bits that approve industry stuff, and later on discuss the contentious bit, as she calls it, which is the environment bit. Anyway, Roger Cook, who had a great part in drawing this up with good old Murray, he now says he's got some reservations, as has his industry thing, because there's one clause there they're a bit upset about.
One clause, okay.
Yes, yeah. Well, not one. There's several, but the one that really worries them is the minister can intervene if something's approved and not approve it if it's deemed to have, quote, unacceptable impacts.
I heard there was a bit more ministerial discretion in this, so apparently it can go either way, Kevin.
Yeah, that's right, it can indeed. Now, unacceptable impacts might mean, say, blowing up Juukan Gorge, or which has already happened, so that won't happen, or approving stuff that will destroy the rock art, but that's already happened, so that won't happen. But anyway, unacceptable impacts. And I think what they consider unacceptable impacts are the fact that it will stop them doing what they want to do.
Yeah.
And that's an unacceptable impact.
I wish I had an unacceptable clause in my life, an unacceptable impact clause. I just wave it at people.
So that's the go.
They've gutted the EPBC basically, haven't they?
But also, we're going to go to Helen Vandenberg in a minute too, but Rolls-Royce, of course, which makes cars that we can't afford and shouldn't be on the road anyway because they're bloody big burners and I don't know if they make an electric car these days, are they? I'm not sure. Anyway, you'll be pleased to know Victoria, this is great news again.
Good. Hold on to your hats.
Victoria is set to play a critical role in developing homegrown nuclear talent to maintain AUKUS submarines under a new agreement with global powerhouse Rolls-Royce, because Rolls-Royce has now become more of a merchant of death than making of cars.
Military-industrial complex into Victoria.
Rolling-Roycing, yes. a memorandum of understanding between the Allan government and the luxury car manufacturer turned global defence and aerospace giant week could pave the way for new Rolls-Royce tech centres and collaborations with Melbourne universities. While it won't lead to nuclear storage or facilities in the state, it could develop the expertise for sustaining and maintaining submarines built in South Australia. It's the only private company in the world, the old Rolls, in the world with the nuclear capability to manage reactor design, manufacture and commissioning in one place, and is expanding its UK and global operations to cater for the sub-steel. The agreement allows us, says the government, Rolls-Royce has got a bloke called a submarines president, and he said the agreement was about developing nuclear skills and supply chains in country. It allows us to support Australia in establishing a sustainable supply chain in country while developing homegrown nuclear talent and well-paid careers for Australian people. Isn't that wonderful? And they point out that we have 8 world-leading universities with advanced research and development capabilities to create local expertise. So again, it's the defence industry moving into academia.
It is, isn't it? It's a case of you get what you pay for. So where the money goes, that's where you, you know, where your decision making
is. And we're also considering, this arose out of that defence thing last week where the coppers bashed up people protesting about it, the Merchants of Death conference thing in Sydney, Expo in Sydney. Mm. The coppers, I think everyone knows the dichotomy and the irony of the coppers bashing up people fighting for peace and then giving a permit to an Nazis last weekend to line up at Parliament House. But let's let that one slide.
Okay.
But the Israeli government company behind the country's famous Iron Dome missile interception system is pitching its technology to the Defence Department as security experts call on the government to bolster its investment in missiles to protect Australia's major cities and critical infrastructure from attack. We're considering, therefore, buying the defence system from this wonderful Israeli defence company. Isn't that great at the moment? And, of course, yesterday, while many people were talking about the dismissal, the really important people in society were celebrating war. I mean, Remembrance Day is supposed to remember that war is a bad thing, but they turn it into a glorification of killing people, which was happened yesterday. Let's get Helen Vandenberg on the line and cheer people up even more.
Okay. Thanks, Kev. All right. We're talking about rich people, so here's our favourite song by Carsey Blanton.
Seem like bad news all of the time. We got floods and fires and wars and crime. They try to tell me who I ought to blame, but I know who it is because it's always the same. Don't be ashamed if you get confused when you talk to your friends or you watch the news. They try to tell you where it all went wrong, and you don't need to argue, just sing this song. It was rich people stacking the deck, rich people with big fat checks, rich people having a ball, rich people been giving us all. I had a job and it paid all right, but they laid me off last Thursday night. They tried to tell me where the money went, but I know who it was pinching every cent. It was rich people stacking the deck, rich people with big fat checks, rich people, they're having a ball, rich people just Now you know the important words. Rich people, it ain't the Jews. Rich people don't pay no dues. Rich people, it ain't the blacks. Rich people don't pay no taxes. Rich people, it ain't immigration. It's rich people and corporations. Rich people, it ain't rednecks. It's rich people with big fat checks. Rich people, they're having a ball. Rich people been f***ing us all.
Okay, you can back announce that again, Anne, just what that was. That
we're
song,
listening
Rich People.
To Rich People by Carsey Blanton.
Yes, well, that's sort of we rich people like us. We were talking about rich people earlier, weren't we? And speaking of rich people, we've got someone who's at least rich in thought and ideas. On the line, Helen Vandenberg, a long-time campaigner on all sorts of things these days, heavily involved with water issues. And Helen, we've had lots of rain in the last few days, but has that done much to offset the long-term problem?
No. Would be nice if it did. It means people don't have to go out and water their gardens. Means there may have been a little bit of inflow, but, I mean, in the big picture, since 2017, when we got the water resource assessment from Victoria, we've known that rainfall has decreased on the western side of Melbourne between 21 and 25%. And in fact, the Moorabool and Maribyrnong catchments have been severely impacted. That stream inflow was predicted to reduce by 17%. But in actual fact, because of the expansions of dams in the west after the millennium drought, we've now had a 19% interception of stream flow. So that's water that's captured in dams. Now, legitimate agriculture is fine, but when it's in an aesthetic dam, that's a bit of a worry. So there's less rainfall. So with less rainfall, there's less water infiltrating and getting down into groundwater. Now, because we are a naturally dry area from October every year to May, we rely on that groundwater to feed our streams. Now, unfortunately, another reason we're not getting groundwater recharge is because we have, if you think of all the development in Sunbury, which is massive, the increase in hard surfaces in both the middle suburbs and the outer suburbs and the peri-urban areas like Romsey and Riddles Creek, that means there's less water in groundwater. So, for instance, at Deep Creek, which flows from Lancefield down to Buller and then joins with the Jackson's Creek to make the Maribyrnong. So if you go up to Lancefield, there's an area there that has a management plan and where theoretically, there's a watch on how much water is taken out and consumed and who's been given permission to do it, but there's no metering, so you don't really know if people are adhering to it, although that's gradually being changed. So groundwater is critical for us. So we have deep pools in Deep Creek where the species can hang out together in that water and they'll be ready to flow downstream when there's rain later on. Unfortunately, these refuge pools are short of water around at Dobbert's Bridge near Lancefield, and Greater Western Water and Melbourne Water have been trucking emergency water to that to keep that pool going because it's an area, this is where the endangered pygmy perch lives. And they will migrate downstream later on if there's flow. Pardon the plain noise. So we're short of rainfall, we're short of groundwater, we have an increase in stormwater, which is very detrimental to creeks because it brings heavy metals in, and those heavy metals are toxic to the species in the water. So all in all, we're short of water, and it's been known since 2006 that the Maribyrnong in particular needs 7 billion litres extra a year to be healthy. And 19 years later, we still don't have that water. So we know the river's unhealthy and nothing's been done much to improve itself, right? In spite of river health strategies saying it would happen, in spite of the sustainable water strategy says, well, we might be able to get you some water by 2032. We might, right? And if you want to get that water, we'll have to look at using recycled water. And we said, well, that's fine, seeing there's a surplus of wastewater going into the sewerage plants because of the increase in population. There's plenty of that water around, but at the moment it's not fit for purpose because although when it's that water is treated for turning into drinking water, elsewhere you can get the pathogens out of it. They don't remove all the medications, the pharmaceuticals that people have excreted. They don't remove the illegal drugs that have also been excreted through urine. They don't remove personal care products. And so you really have to improve the waste treatment plant so that you can bring...
So it can be water. Done, but they need to spend more money.
It can be done. And you can bring that water up to drinking water standards. It's done in 154 places around the world. So we have a surplus of water in treatment plants, and a government that says, oh, well, we'll consider using that for environmental flows. Now, at the moment, there's a project going with Greater Western Water and RMIT that is a positive step in the right direction, where they're looking at what's the impact of that water. And we don't know fully yet because we haven't finished a year of surveying. And the Maribyrnong River and Waterways Support Association has given that conditional support. Our purpose is to say we want the best quality water we can get for our river, and it has to be non-toxic to the tiny species in there. The unfortunate part about that process is that while Greater Western Water has been transparent about it and they have involved the community in it, and they're very keen for it to be successful, the place selected is downstream, is in Sunbury, yet you've got treatment plants sending out the current standard of water from Gisborne and Riddles Creek, which is coming down that far. So they compare, we're comparing the water around Sunbury to the water coming downstream. So we are hoping that we will be able to get, and Greater Western Water, you can see, is keen to reduce their impact on the rivers and creeks that they rely on for supplying potable water and the groundwater. But they're not going to be able to do that while the government and the Federal Service Commission is saying, oh, you've got to keep prices down. How are they going to get the required money for infrastructure upgrades? Now, for instance, there's a National Water Authority to whom you can apply for extra money to upgrade your pipes for your potable water supply, right? Now, Greater Western Water applied, and Maribyrnong River and Waterways Association supported that and asked for additional funds so we could accelerate the growth of the implementation of getting the right pipes, the right width connected right through the catchment. And lo and behold, the federal government didn't support it. So now, with rising costs, they will have to then cut back on other programs that they were doing because that's essential work. So I'm really pretty frustrated with the federal and state governments at this stage because they are not understanding the critical need in the west of Melbourne for having better infrastructure for the supply of water and for upgrading and getting upgraded waste treatment centres plants so that we could get that water up to potable water standard and to river health standards.
Do you think the fact that it's the west of Melbourne in council, I mean, if it was the east of Melbourne, might they do it?
Well, they're not doing it there either, and we've all got the problem. Everything from the Gippsland Lakes down to the Glenelg River in the west here, we've all got this same problem, and we are all yelling at the government. Well, we've been talking with the government.
Yeah.
And we're talking with the government agencies to make sure that we understand the data. What's the data they've got? How rigorous is it? What are the data gaps in it? Well, we've shown them that in some cases we have better data than their computers. And they've been, it's been a constructive, collaborative dialogue. But we're not getting the investment from government, right? And it doesn't seem to be on the agenda that they're going to seriously and rapidly improve water infrastructure to enhance the efficiency of the system,
Helen,
to get a better standard.
That would frustrate me no end because, you know, our understanding from the economics is that the federal government cannot run out of the Australian dollars because dollars are just an accounting operation. So they could well fund the state government to do this kind of infrastructure improvement. The only thing they can run out of are the pipes and the people that can lay them.
Exactly.
Mm. Anyway, so I thought I'd have my 2 cents there.
I'm very pleased to hear you say that because we're frustrated because the data is there and the problem is there, but the solution is there and it only requires investment.
Right.
Now, at the moment, look at the data centres. Where are they coming? Cheap land. Oh, out to the north and the west, right? Into the very driest areas that you've got outside of the desert in Victoria, go west. For Werribee, for Maribyrnong and Werribee, right?
Mm.
I mean, it's just...
So where can people go to sort of help you get the word out about this? Is there petitions or anything?
There are two places.
Mm.
We have got the Maribyrnong River and Waterways Association has got our position paper on data centres, in which, and that's on our website.
And can you give out the URL of the website?
Yeah, I'll just do
if you've
that.
Got it there, I'll put you on the spot there.
No, it's I can. You go to the Maribyrnong River and Waterways Association. Mm. Hold on, I'll just go.
The Maribyrnong Rivers and Waterways, Association. Yeah. People can probably Google that and find it. Yeah.
Hold on, I've got our position statement here, and the link for it is https://// Maribyrnong River. .org.au Maribyrnong River.org.au.
Okay.
Now, and then when you get,
go on.
And if you go there, I'm just looking at the page now. Oh, it's not going to be friendly. All right. Let's start again, Helen.
But you can find a report that you've got?
Yeah, we can. There's also a report on the concerned water, and if you go to our advocacy, and across the top it's got home about volunteer education events, our river advocacy. Mm-hmm. If you click on the advocacy, it says key water policies, campaigns, position statements. So then you click on position statements, and there it is. And what we're calling for, and they can write to the minister because we've already done this.
Yeah,
people can write to the minister and ask that there be a more, that the government make regulation. Now, the government fast tracks in the planning system approvals for data centres. Data centres are very hot. They generate a lot of heat and then they therefore consume a lot of, then they, it's cheaper for them to use water to cool, drinking water, to cool their computer systems, right?
So we're talking about the data systems that are used to run the worldwide interweb, and also, of course, coming down the pipeline is AI, and it's going to be using a lot more computing power.
Yeah, well, then they're going to be very hot, and because compared to energy, water is very cheap, and business gets it cheaper than we do.
Right.
So, and there are no requirements for mandating efficiency of
the use
requiring
of the water.
Water usage efficiency.
Oh, wow.
There's no demand that they use recycled water. I mean, you can. We've got plenty of recycled water, and we've got a purple pipe system in some homes that now have no gardens. So why wouldn't you have a purple pipe system that takes recycled water to the data centres? And we think there's a need to protect the potable water supply rather than having it consumed by industry here. And we think the pricing should be fairer. It should be, I mean, why is water cheaper for industry than it is for the average person?
Yeah, in fact, Melbourne Water, of course, we know the state government's trying to encourage data centres, which means more pressure on electricity and water. But Melbourne Water warned that it's getting applications from what they call hyperscale data centres, which use large amounts of water to cool servers, with water demands exceeding those of nearly all top 30 non-residential customers in the city. In the 2026 water pricing submission, the utility stated this sudden massive demand had not been accounted for in its demand forecasts or expenditure planning. The authority said it would be prudent to collect upfront capital contributions from these new customers for any infrastructure upgrades so that the financial burden did not fall on the broader customer base.
Well, this is the point. We'll be at the moment, we're subsidising industry. When we pay our water bills, we're subsidising industry. So we take the cost, they get the profit. And the state has the cost of infrastructure upgrading, which is proceeding at a glacier pace at the moment.
Yeah, and I mean, and that, of course, the fact that we're encouraging more and more data centres when... you know, without taking into account the impact on energy generally and on water...
Well, as I say, people in the driest continent in the world, there seems to be an assumption that we have an endless supply of water. And yet all the government data shows we are facing water shortages, which can be overcome to a large degree through the use of recycled water. And the government does not seem to have an appetite for saying to rational people out there in the community, hey, how about we invest in changing the recycled water to drinking water standards, which is done elsewhere. I mean, anybody who's been to London and drunk their water has had recycled water. Where's the yuck factor in that? It's not rational to say in a dry country, particularly on the dry northwest, we don't need to worry about water. We do, because we're going to have less water in the future falling from the sky. And when it comes, it's going to be coming in heavy storms. It's likely to be falling in summer, not in winter. There is a problem staring us in the face to which we need to start quiet, calmly planning how we're going to manage it. And for all the titles in the world about sustainable water strategies, if you don't fund what the recommendations were and you slow down the implementation of that, that is not responsible government. And you can't blame the water corporations, because the water corporations are constrained, their budgets are highly constrained by government, which also takes dividends out of water corporations. Government doesn't want bills to go up. So there's a clear message to the water corporations, keep your bills down. And the Essential Service Commission is part of that process of suppressing the prices.
Hmm. In terms of the obvious shortage we're facing, does desalination come into it again as well?
Well, they have. Look, the one good thing the government has done recently is put out its water security plan for Greater Melbourne and Geelong, and they've hinted at using a desal plant for Ballarat and Geelong. And that was indicated in the sustainable water strategy that we needed to look at that because of the expanding populations. While government drives population growth, government has to drive water security at the same time. Now, those things take a while to plan, right? In the interim, they're ignoring the fact, now, they probably will need a desal plant at some stage to do that. However, where you'd put it and how big it would be and all of that has to be planned, and you have to have consultation about it. In the meantime, we have oodles of recycled water that is not being used, and farmers down in Werribee don't use the available stuff because it's too salty, so it obviously needs an upgrade. There is all that recycled water which you could be then turning into potable water.
Mm.
It's a rational thing to do, to take recycled water up to environmental water and potable water. And I think it's something that the federal government needs to assist Victoria with.
Yeah, because unfortunately desalination does have impacts on the ecology of the water around it. You know, the brine goes back into the ocean, for instance, and throws everything into confusion.
Well, I don't know. I have been asking about that, and so far the people that I know that have been following it are saying that there is an impact, but it's not a serious impact. I mean, if we don't do this, you can expect the collapse of the river systems from the Snowy to at least the Barwon.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay? So if we don't do something to... And it's quite clear in every available government document on water that the rivers have not got another drop to give, that they're all suffering. So it doesn't matter whether you're looking at the Snowy, the Thompson, the Mitchell, the Latrobe, the Yarra system, the Maribyrnong, the Werribee, or the Barwon, or the Moorabool system, right? They are all short of water for their rivers. None of us have got the right environmental flows that we need. And why? Because we're drinking it.
Yeah, well, of course,
our rivers.
That the point was made from a different perspective in the terms of fire by the Country Fire Authority this week that said that we saw record rainfall deficits across much of the state this year, and they're predicting the worst bushfire season since Black Saturday. And it comes again down to the fact that there's just not been enough rainfall.
Yeah, well, for instance, around Lancefield, they've had half their annual rainfall. Half. Now, it was never a high rainfall anyhow. So they've had 189 mils this year, I think it is. Right? Now, my ground started cracking in my garden months ago. Every time we get a decent downpour, it gets back together. And our clays are very reactive now because they've been compacted. And so the water runs off them rather than soaks into them. But anyhow, that's another story. The point is, we are dry. We've got an expanding population. The federal government has not done anything much to help anybody with the increase in demand for water. We need to expand our water grid, and we need to bring our recycled water up to potable water. Where's the federal government on this?
Yeah, well, take that as rhetorical. But Heffernan, who's head of the CFA, he said the best-case scenario, which would require daily rain for the next 3 months, would only bring the state back to a normal bushfire season. So we really are in a bit of strife, aren't we?
Yeah. I mean, when you don't have water, you have a problem. And we've never had much water. And we don't reuse it. Why is it that we're encouraged to reuse any bit of plastic that we buy, but we're not encouraged to reuse water?
Another good question.
Yeah. Helen, can we, in the few minutes we've got left, could I take you to another one of your favourites? Because a few weeks ago we did an interview about the projected huge incinerators at Wallet and Lara. And the people objecting to them, and of course it's they're being promoted by your old mate Cleanaway.
Yeah, well, they seem to be good friends with the government, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, the question is, how are you going to manage the dioxin emissions that invariably come from those facilities? And I know there is a plant in Paris that has, most of the time, has no dioxin emissions from it. Will we get that quality if we have these things? And if not, the cancer rate's going to go up.
Yeah. And, of course, your old favourite, the Tullamarine toxic waste dump, I presume that's still there and nothing's happened.
That's right. It's still... there's been no community consultation called for the Tullamarine Landfill Community Consultation Group. Cleanaway have not convened one meeting this year, and we're still not getting our report on the hydrology of the area, which is really important. I mean, that's a toxic dump that's leaking, will continue to leak forever, for at least another 100 years while the chemical reactions go on. And it's on the banks of the Mooney Ponds Creek, and it's leaking 122 chemicals into the groundwater that shoots a variety of creeks, and it's heading towards the Maribyrnong River, Steel Creek, and the bay.
The bay,
and,
yeah.
And the ocean, because groundwater can shoot out via the creeks, it can go via the rivers, it can go via the bay, and it can go out to the ocean. Because, it does what it does. And that's the way it flows to the lowest point.
And we've mentioned before that you believe there's a higher incidence of certain cancers in the vicinity.
Yep. There's 235 cancers in 7 clusters on our current map. Within 1.5 kilometres of the dump, because that's the fallout zone.
It comes back to the EPA and the government forcing Cleanaway to do what it needs to do, wasn't it? I mean, ultimately.
Well, of course. But, we can't even get air quality monitoring on a regular basis. I mean, when we brought out our first health report by Harry Van Morse from Western Region Environment Centre, and when that was publicised, the government decided that they would convene a meeting, and they did offer air quality, but they made it voluntary. The Cleanaway were allowed to volunteer to do it, so when they didn't want to do it anymore, they don't do it. So when there's an environmental audit every 3 years, you'll find out then what's going on. But, it'll be too late, because on one occasion we found that exceeded the dioxin levels and nothing was done about it. And they tried to blame a fire somewhere else in another region, and we pointed out that that was upwind, that it was the wind was blowing. They said that wind, that the wind had forced that down to our area, and that's why we got a bad reading. And we said, well, unfortunately, that's not the way the wind was blowing on that day. The wind was blowing from Tullamarine towards the fire, so we didn't get that. That went further north.
Yeah, and of course, clean away rather than clean it up are, in fact, promoting more pollution for the for that part of the world, the northwestern area of Melbourne.
Yeah, well, I was speaking to a councillor the other day in Hume, and he said, well, if you put, he's only got a certain amount of land available for development to create jobs in his area, this is in the city of Hume, two data centres would fill that in and they'd get 10 jobs out of it probably.
Yeah. Well, on that note, on that happy note, we've got to go, Helen. The time's up. But look, thanks for your time. Look, we probably won't talk again this year, but thanks for all the help you give us all year. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation, and I look forward to chatting with you next year.
Shall do.
Have
okay.
A relaxing summer.
Cheer people up again. Okay. Thanks, Helen, and thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Helen.
Helen Vandenberg of Cash and Tell is a wonderful campaigner.
She's amazing.
Yeah, she never stops, never stops. She had a meeting at 9 o'clock this morning and was available at 9.30 for us, so she just keeps going. And it's time for Joe Next Door. Next week is, I don't know what next. Oh, it's actually the second, I said the fourth, didn't I? It's the second Wednesday. I'm totally confused. Next week is housing.
Housing. It's housing next week with City Limits at 9 a.m.
Thanks, Anne.
And we will be back. Thanks a lot, Kevin.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.